This month on War News Radio, Voices of Discontent, we're showcasing different stories of protest and independence going on simultaneously around the world. First up, we speak with demonstrators at the People's Climate March. Next, we hear the first part of a two-part series about how living and traveling in Israel shapes perspectives on the conflict. After that is Filibustered, which is focusing this month on the complex relationship between Kurdish independence and the United States. Finally, we discuss the current state of the protest in Hong Kong. But first, a roundup of this week's news.
As attacks by the Sunni extremist group continue, Turkey's parliament voted on Thursday to deploy Turkish troops to go into Syria and Iraq. Earlier this week, in an attempt to scare citizens resisting the Islamic State, militants beheaded 7 men and 3 women in northern Syria. Just days later, a car bomb in Baghdad killed 15 and wounded another 40. The United Nations predicts that in the month of September, at least 1,119 Iraqis have been killed due to violence. This number is projected to be the absolute minimum number of casualties, as it does not include deaths in areas controlled by the Islamic State group. The Turkish parliament agreed to join the international coalition against the Islamist militants as they continue to capture territory south of Turkey's border.
4 civilians were killed by shelling at an elementary school in the Ukrainian city of Donetsk Wednesday. Elsewhere in the city, 6 others died when their vehicle was struck. Rebel leaders blamed the attacks on government forces, while the Ukrainian government pointed to the rebels. Both shellings occurred close to the Donetsk airport, which pro-Russian separatists have striven to capture. The airport is currently held by government forces, using it as a base for shelling strategic locations in the rebel city. The ceasefire agreement reached by Russia and Ukraine in September has not put an end to the violence.
3 Mexican Army soldiers were sentenced for homicide this past Tuesday. The charges stem from an incident on June 30th in Tlatelolco, Mexico, when members of the Mexican Army killed 22 people. The Army claims that the incident was a firefight with a gang. Witnesses and evidence disagree. One witness claims that the people had surrendered, which is consistent with the lack of expended shells that seem to indicate that an intense battle did not occur. Pressure from human rights groups, including Amnesty International, for an unbiased investigation into these possible executions has pushed the government to action.
President Obama approved a program on Tuesday to address the influx of children fleeing violence in Central America and seeking to enter the U.S. The plan is to set up in-country refugee processing in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Children will be able to go to the immigration centers to determine if they qualify for a refugee visa without making the dangerous trek to the U.S. border. Up to 4,000 of such minors who have family members already living in the U.S. will be granted visas in the coming fiscal year.
The Ebola epidemic continues to intensify across parts of West Africa. The disease has claimed more than 3,000 lives throughout Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The Bambali district, which includes one of Sierra Leone's largest cities, went from a single confirmed case on August 15th to over 190 reported cases and at least 90 deaths this weekend. The whole country has been hit by something for which it was not ready, says Dr. Amara Jambi, the Director of Prevention and Control at Sierra Leone's Health Ministry. Many countries have vowed to bring more aid to the region, but the outbreak is still far from under control. According to Anthony Banbury, the Secretary General's Special Representative, the rate of infections is growing exponentially. The total number of cases is doubling every 3 weeks, and the number of deaths is now greater from this outbreak than in all previous Ebola outbreaks in the history of the world.
Over 5,500 civilians have died due to violence in Iraq since ISIS began its advancement in early June, stated a UN report released today. There have been 9,437 dead and 17,386 wounded in Iraq since January. According to a UN report, these numbers are the absolute minimums. UN Human Rights Chief Saeed Raed Zayed al-Hussein said, quote, "The array of violations and abuses perpetrated by ISIL and associated arms groups is staggering. Many of their acts may amount to war crimes or crimes against humanity." In the days leading up to this report, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abdi told the BBC that he would refuse ground support from any nation, and air support from Arab nations in particular. Meanwhile, the Kurdish Peshmergas, bolstered by air support from the US, UK, and France, have made actual advances against ISIS in Iraq's northern regions. Areas recaptured by the Peshmergas in recent days include Zumar, a town near the Mosul Dam, and several towns north of the ISIS-controlled cities of Mosul and Sinjar.
40 rioters were killed and 54 civilians injured after a series of explosions on Sunday, September 21st, in China's Xinjiang region. The explosions were directed at 2 police stations, a market, and a store. Due to restricted access to the region and the difficulty of verifying information, it is currently unclear whether the rioters died in the blasts or were shot by police after the blast. There has been heavy security in the region in the days after this event, accompanied by a four-day news blackout. Xinjiang is home to over 10 million Uyghur Muslims, many of whom the Chinese government characterizes as Muslim extremists. This outbreak of violence came just a few days before Muslim Uyghur scholar Ilham Tohti was sentenced to life in prison on charges of separatism. Over the past year, violence in this region between locals and security forces has claimed over 200 lives.
At least 3 people were killed and 7 more were injured in a Taliban attack on an Afghan army bus in Kabul. This suicide bombing is the latest in a series of Taliban attacks in Afghanistan since the swearing-in of new President Ashraf Ghani on Monday. President Ghani signed a security deal with the United States that allows for the presence of American troops in Afghanistan after 2014. The Taliban opposed the pact and have since claimed responsibility for 4 attacks that have harmed soldiers and civilians. The first 2 suicide attacks together killed 7 Afghan soldiers and wounded 20 more.
Thousands of Hong Kong citizens gathered on major roads and public spaces to demonstrate in favor of democracy and universal suffrage. Following a citywide student strike that began on September 22nd, Occupy Central organizer Benny Tai announced the beginning of the movement on the morning of September 27th. While Tai initiated the protests, the gatherings are not under the control of any particular group. Prominent demands from protesters include removing the nomination committee from the National People's Congress proposal for Hong Kong's chief executive elections and the resignation of current chief executive Liang Chun-ying. 370 local and international solicitors, among others, have condemned the police's use of tear gas, pepper spray, and batons to disperse the crowds. The movement is known as the Umbrella Revolution for protesters' use of umbrellas to shield themselves from tear gas and pepper spray.
If you want to hear more from War News Radio, visit us online at warnewsradio.org. This week's newscast was written and edited by Natasha Chalk, Rachel Diamond, Amy DePiro, Leo Elliott, Amelia Erskine, Allison Raybar, Catherine Kwok, Sabrina Merrill, Sarah Morrell, Jerry Kinn, Rachel Sasala, Lily Tyson, and Tyler Welsh. Our piece editors are Allison Raybar, Sabrina Merrill, Jerry Kinn, and Leo Elliott. I'm John Gagnon.
On Tuesday, September 23rd, 2014, world leaders convened in New York City for a global summit on climate action. On Sunday, as leaders were arriving, an estimated 410,000 people from around the world congregated in Manhattan for the People's Climate March to demonstrate their concern toward inaction on climate change by world governments. War News Radio's Peter Hahn and Sadie Rittman talked to student organizers, marchers from all walks of life, and coalition leaders who put the march together to find out what the People's Climate March hoped to achieve, who showed up, and what's next for activists, old and new, and the ever-growing climate justice movement. Patrick Hahn reports.
Those were young student protesters voicing their discontent against climate inaction by world leaders, many of whom convened in New York on Sunday, September 21st, for a global climate summit at the behest of UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Not only was this the largest and by some counts most inclusive climate march in U.S. history, the mass-scale demonstration was joined by more than 2,600 solidarity marches from 162 countries, ranging from London to Tanzania.
When we were marching in 2 different spots, I had these big screens as we were entering and exiting Times Square that had like videos of people marching across the world. So there were 2,800 solidarity marches and events throughout the world.
Student organizers at our very own Swarthmore College, which has a student body of about 1,500 students, rallied more than 200 students to travel to New York on Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of work, a lot of like late nights responding to lots of emails.
A diverse set of reasons compelled students to wake up before 7 a.m. Sunday morning to hop on a bus to New York. Some students, like Nathan Graff, saw the march as a way for a broad coalition of stakeholders to stand in solidarity with the millions who have suffered due to climate change.
So I think everyone wants to register their discontent and anger and fear around what's happening with the climate and who's ruining it. I think that Climate March is an excellent chance to break the tragedy of the commons.
Swarthmore student organizer Olivia Ortiz also hoped this awareness would inspire action.
At the very least, and especially for our campus, I think it's going to energize things like divestment campaigns, like on-campus sustainability. It's going to make people want to move, being here, being such, feeding off all this energy. Yeah, it's going to make people want to move.
Other students, such as Martin Froger Silva, were more skeptical of the march having an immediate impact, but still agreed that the march was important in raising awareness.
I don't know if it's going to achieve much. I have my doubts. But I think that showing people who aren't aware that this march is happening, raising the issue to their consciousness.
Lee Smithy, coordinator of the Peace and Conflict Studies program at Swarthmore College, agrees that the immediate effects of the march are not clear-cut, but that these kind of mass demonstrations are necessary in the fight for climate justice.
I think it's often hard to measure what the impact of any one given campaign or action is going to be, whether it's going to be political pressure or raising public awareness, or, you know, this is also about building networks that make further actions possible. I think it's entirely possible that we will look back on this climate march and say that that was one turning point among others in the broad sweep of change.
Swarthmore student activist Guido Gergent, a New Yorker, thought the strength of the march lay within the diversity of groups represented.
This is the largest climate march in United States history. It is an incredible showing of the diversity and power of the climate movement. This is not simply about just the planet. It is also about workers, indigenous communities, families, women, LGBTQ community, coming together to say we all have a common interest and a common vision in a just and sustainable future.
Olivia Ortiz was also happy about the magnitude and inclusivity that the march achieved.
This is just so big, and it's so amazing that so many people from so many different walks of life and so many interests want to come together in March for a very predetermined period of time and space and kind of make a spectacle of ourselves and show that we care.
The march organizers reflected this aspiration for inclusivity in the way they organized the different blocks of the march. The procession was led by the frontline communities of indigenous peoples who are disproportionately affected by climate change. They were followed by labor and student groups, environmental groups, social justice groups, climate scientists, and lastly, the all-inclusive group for everyone else.
Also, one of the things that I really appreciated that I highlighted was like the people that are on the front lines of climate change and on the front lines of our fossil fuel economy who were placed at the front of the march to be leading, to symbolize how they can be leading the fight and how they are.
The demonstrators were also diverse in age. They were toddlers marching with their parents.
Change the climate for a better future, if there is any.
They were middle-aged parents.
So I came in today with my wife and both my kids. I have a 6-year-old boy and an 11-year-old girl. Here mostly for them. I feel like my generation, and of course generations before mine, have been incredibly irresponsible, and we're really at a crossroads of history. If we don't do something now, I feel like their lives are going to be drastically different, and they're not even on the front lines. They're relatively well off. When you get to be middle-aged, as I am, and you have kids, you start raising your kids, a couple things happen. One, you tend to have a bigger carbon footprint and be a little bit less activist than you were in your youth. But two, at the same time, your conscience gets bigger, and you start to worry about the future you're leaving your children and your children's children and the whole planet.
And there are many retired couples.
Well, we've been involved in the anti-fracking movement in central New York since 2009. In my retirement, I'm spending 4 or 5 hours a day at least in this fight.
The march even spanned the entire political spectrum. One woman sported a t-shirt that read, "Just another Republican who supports climate justice." Right next to her was a younger woman distributing socialist literature.
Well, I think that as a Marxist, the environment, obviously, planet Earth is a huge part, and I think the crisis that's going on right now is capitalism.
Not far behind, Episcopalian nuns marched next to a bearded war protester.
policies leading to a better future in terms of climate, those are the policies for the 99%. Okay? War is the ultimate policy for the 1%.
We're kin with all of creation, and we're not just stewards of creation, we're kin. And so we have to stand up for it. And we're putting our boots to the ground.
Demonstrators had such dramatically different reasons for coming to the march under the big tent banner of climate justice, and so many different hopes for what it would achieve. So what was the People's Climate March trying to accomplish?
Well, the audience was the world leaders, so that they will know that the world is watching, that the world is not going to sit by and let them make a slipshod policy that is not going to make a substantial change. The other goal of the march was to bring everyone into this conversation.
That was Ravi Ragbir, the lead immigrant group's organizer for the People's Climate March. Many climate activists, however, criticized the People's Climate March for watering down the movement to fit everyone under its inclusive big tent and appeal to the masses. As a recent article in The Nation puts it, critics portrayed the march as a quote-unquote depoliticized corporate-friendly sellout. Instead, they pointed to the Flood Wall Street protest, a more militant and direct action that occurred the day after the march, in which hundreds of protesters wore blue and attempted to rush into the financial district to disrupt business as usual.
Flood Wall Street was conceived as a kind of follow-up to the People's Climate March and a chance to leverage the power of the People's Climate March and harness it so that it could be directed at the corporations and the individuals most responsible for the climate crisis.
Sarah Blazevic, a senior at Swarthmore, was one of the students who participated in Flood Wall Street.
Corporations like Goldman Sachs and Bank of America that fund mountaintop removal coal mining and contribute in massive ways to the extractive economy.
The slogan of Flood Wall Street was "Capitalism equals climate chaos." To these more radical protesters, the climate movement needs to shift from reform to revolt.
What actually happened was that we met up Monday morning in Battery Park, and then there was a sort of flood towards the stock exchange where everybody walked towards the stock exchange and there were barricades set up before the stock exchange, so we did a sit-in. And about 3,000 people sat in and participated in this and basically stopped traffic in the financial district. And later on in the night, after the quote-unquote official part of the action had dispersed, about 100 people decided to stay and get arrested.
To Sarah, change won't happen until the people reject an extractive capitalist economy as a legitimate economic system.
You know, it's not enough to change our light bulbs and it's not enough to march in the streets, but the companies that are funding extraction and funding the climate crisis need to be held accountable, and they need to understand that thousands and thousands of people want them to change their practices.
On the other hand, the student outreach director of the march, Youngjung Cho, pointed out that the climate justice movement needs both mass mobilizations and more direct actions.
I personally believe that hundreds of thousands of people were politicized on Monday or were inspired or excited and are taking that energy back to their home communities or to their college campuses, and I feel really hopeful about that.
Most students and demonstrators agreed that whether or not the march was perfectly inclusive, it was better than political apathy and cynicism.
Be awesome if it led to a just transition to a fossil-free world, but I'm not completely optimistic about that, but at least it's worth coming to do something in response to that.
Perhaps this is best summarized by the name of the last block of the march, We Need Everybody. Maybe the real importance and success of the People's Climate March is embodied in the moment of silence held at 12:58 p.m. to remember and stand in solidarity with those who have suffered and died due to effects of climate change. At 1 p.m., a wave of screaming rolled through the two-mile procession, sounding an alarm to both policymakers and the ordinary folks around the world who must hold them accountable to climate action. So what next steps should climate justice activists take now?
I would say going back to where you have roots, whether like that's where you currently live or if that is a college campus. If there is an active campaign for climate justice or another issue that you feel really passionately about, listening and seeing what the needs are and getting involved.
Civil disobedience and direct action alone won't solve the climate crisis, and we need to be pushing the institutions that we're a part of to leverage their power and revoke the social license of the fossil fuel industry.
Whether or not the march was a success, only time will tell. But one thing is for sure. The coalition building and mass mobilization that was made possible by the People's Climate March had a noble purpose: to embody these words of Lila Watson. If you have come here to help me, you are wasting our time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. For War News Radio, I'm Patrick Hahn.
On last month's show, we heard a collection of voices on the conflict between Israel and Palestine. War News Radio's Amy DePiro follows this up with the first part of a two-part series about young people that grew up in the United States, but have lived or currently are living in Israel.
At the beginning of this story, Amelia Dornbush is a practicing Jew, and she's relatively well-informed about Israel and Palestine. She has attended one protest in her life, and even this was small and safe and had nothing to do with that faraway conflict. No security forces were called. No shots were fired. At the end of this story, Amelia has been in a very different kind of protest, this one in the West Bank. She has felt tear gas sting her eyes and sound grenades pound her ears. At the end of this story, she is no longer sure how to be a practicing Jew, because she believes she has witnessed great violence in the name of a Jewish state.
I'm never really entirely comfortable telling these experiences because I feel like it casts me in a light I don't want to be cast in. I was extraordinarily complicit. I still am fairly complicit. And at the same time, I think one of the main reasons behind inviting internationals is so that we can go back and share the story. And so not talking sort of defeats the entire purpose of me having been there in the first place.
That's Amelia. She's a student at Swarthmore College studying theater and religion. She's also a member of Swarthmore Hillel, a Jewish student group that organizes religious services and other events on campus.
I studied abroad in Jerusalem. I naively thought that I could do so without getting involved in politics. I was not planning on going abroad to be politically active in any way. I really genuinely just wanted to study Jewish text. And it seemed that the best place to do that was at this place called Pardes, which is an egalitarian Jewish text study institution. I had some qualms about going abroad. I wasn't really sure how I felt about BDS, but I didn't see a way in which sort of me directly being there would like make or break anything.
BDS, boycott, divest, and sanction. It's a tactic many groups today are using to put economic pressure on the state of Israel by boycotting Israeli goods, divesting from Israeli companies, and advocating sanctions against the Israeli state. Living in West Jerusalem and studying at Pardes, Amelia was in clear violation of the BDS call.
I guess I didn't see how it was connected, which was, in retrospect, quite ignorant. I was thinking I would just go and learn my things, and that would be somehow separate from a system. Very quickly, it became clear that, of course, everything's political. We are in class. I remember this super vividly. We were studying Exodus. There are many ways you can study Exodus. You can do an explicitly political reading of, like, the oppressed rise up. You can sort of study it on its own. You can make modern parallels. You can't.
Exodus, by the way, is the book of the Torah in which Moses leads the Israelites out of slavery under the Pharaoh in Egypt.
My teacher wanted to sort of give us a lesson on how to appreciate water and was talking about how water access was used as a tactic in war, and that's why the river was turned red, and like, think about what it means not to have enough water. And this is a teacher who I happen to know lives in a settlement, and I was just wondering whether she had any sense that there is a water allocation issue, that the amount of water she has is grossly more than the amount of water that someone who's Palestinian who lives right next to her.
Amelia says things like this would happen in class all the time. One student compared Pharaoh to current Arab leaders. Another suggested that Moses' warning to Pharaoh about the coming plagues was like the Israeli Defense Force dropping leaflets before bombing an area in Palestine. Amelia had never heard these familiar stories interpreted like this. All of a sudden, she says, the text she loved to study from an academic or religious point of view seemed retold for a none too subtle political purpose. Scriptures weren't the only texts rewritten. Amelia soon realized that the Hebrew street names on every corner in her neighborhood must be relatively new. Before 1948, her area had been home to Arab Christians. It was more than names, Amelia says. Spaces followed different rules for different people. Friends in her study abroad program could run a marathon through East Jerusalem without problems. But an Arab American friend living there often found it difficult to get home because of blocked roads. This, in a place where ignoring barriers can be deadly. During her stay, many media outlets reported that a 15-year-old Palestinian boy was shot and killed by IDF soldiers as he crossed a broken separation fence. The army said he was vandalizing the barrier. His family said he was trying to harvest an edible plant on the other side for food. One day, Perdace invited students like Amelia to explain why they felt so uncomfortable living in Jerusalem. But rather than catharsis, after talking, Amelia felt physically sick. So sick, she eventually went to the hospital. She gave herself an ultimatum there. Either do something to protest, or leave. When she was feeling better, she decided what to do. She would take a trip with Freedom Theater, a group that offers two-week tours of the West Bank to foreigners. The centerpiece of the trip is a visit to Nabi Saleh, a village of over 500 known for its weekly marches in protest of Israeli settlements in the West Bank.
In the protests, you basically march to get tear gassed, and it's been happening for years. The backstory, as I understand it, to the Nabi Saleh marches is there had been a well that had belonged to the village of Nabi Saleh for a long time. The well had been taken over by settlers. This is not an uncommon story. It is an alarmingly common story. And so when people in Nabi Saleh went to get access to the well, they were denied. The IDF told them they couldn't go there. And so they decided to organize a nonviolent demonstration to get access to the well.
When Amelia visited, protesters gathered on the village hilltop, as they have so many Friday afternoons before. More people joined them, one by one, as they finished prayers. Someone said a few words into a megaphone. They started the march downhill toward the well. A rough translation of the chant you're hearing. With our voices raised, he who has sons never dies. Our moon rises and shines, rises over the refugee camps. Revolution, revolution against the occupation. This is a revolution, not a war.
You're sort of going, and at whatever point the IDF decides they want to, they sort of roll up. And what I was expecting to happen was for there to be a back and forth. Like, you can't cross here, we will cross here. Suddenly, you just hear a shot, which is the tear gas grenade. When tear gas gets fired, right, you have to look for the canister, because if it hits you, you're dead. And when the concussion grenades go off, they're just like waves of sound. They sound like an explosion, so you're looking, you're trying to find, like, where's this thing you need to avoid, but there isn't any.
That sound, by the way, is from a video recorded at the protest Amelia attended. As part of publicizing their work, regular protesters often upload the footage of the marches on YouTube.
I thought, like, this will be a conscious decision. I will be brave, and I will stand. And that was so not the case. Like, tear gas is nasty stuff. And I panicked and fled like a coward. Like, pretty much as soon as I got a whiff of tear gas, first I froze because it kind of numbs your senses a little bit. And then my eyes are streaming. I have asthma, and so I couldn't breathe. And it felt like there's sort of like a line in my throat that I could only get enough air into. I was concerned I was going to die. I don't know. I was completely panicked, and I was just shouting. Then other people, I don't know, just complete... some people from the Freedom Bus, some people were complete strangers. sort of like grabbed me, pulled me up a hill. Someone gave me rubbing alcohol, which sort of like made me come to, and the panic faded. And I apparently was just apologizing the entire time while people were helping me. And I remember, I wouldn't have said that I was doing that, but like once that happened, I sort of remembered this moment of shame. Like I knew, I was like, I shouldn't have gone. Like people are wasting their time helping me when they should really be out there protesting.
That day, the wind was blowing downhill. Amelia says the IDF fired the tear gas canisters so that they would fall above and behind protesters, trailing a cloud downhill after them and hitting their faces if they fled to higher ground. Rubber bullets followed after Amelia herself had fled. Later, experienced protests would tell her that this had been a light day.
Yes, my experiences there were jarring, and yes, they were hard, but in no way, shape, or form could they ever actually compare to what it means to be someone who's Palestinian living there. Like, I am white, I am Jewish, I have an American passport. At any point I wanted to, I could have gone and, like, chilled and relaxed on a beach in Tel Aviv, and that's just not true if you're Palestinian.
Nabi Saleh and Jerusalem behind her, Amelia explains things to herself like this. More than deliberate violence, she says, it's lack of action that makes it hard to move toward a peaceful solution between Israel and Palestine.
It doesn't require active acts of malice, just simply going on autopilot. And I don't think there's this like innately evil core. No, I don't think such a thing exists. What it means to actively oppose a system, it requires a lot of thought, and lack of thought, lack of action is simple complicity, is simple upholding.
This conviction has made it hard for Amelia to know how to practice her religion. It's sometimes even hard to pray.
It's been a while since I've been to services. Absolutely still identify as Jewish. I don't think there's any way I ever won't. I feel like I'm Jewish by, like, protesting outside of Jewish Federation of North America. I feel like I'm Jewish by planning the best way to get Hillel International to stop having certain policies, rather than just, like, being at ease with prayer.
Amelia can barely remember what she thought about Israel and Palestine before her trip. She goes quiet when I ask her. Now, instead, she tells stories of sacred texts and street signs, written and rewritten. And she tells them with lungs that remember the sting of tear gas.
That piece was written and produced by Amy DePiro. In an episode later this year, Amy will share a very different personal story from a young man training to be an IDF soldier. This is War News Radio.
Sometimes it's hard to listen to the news without getting angry. War News Radio's Sarah Morrell and Jay Clayton have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment for all the news that makes you want to tear your hair out.
I make this statement mindful of what Martin Luther King Jr. said in this same ceremony years ago. Violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problem. It merely creates new and more complicated ones.
Who said that exactly? Which major world leader got a Nobel Peace Prize before he actually did anything as president?
Was it Putin?
Our objective is clear. We will degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL through a comprehensive and sustained counterterrorism strategy.
Well, I guess we've discovered that Obama is definitely not a fortune teller.
I, for one, am particularly excited to talk about this round of international conflict. And no, not because I have a 15% share of stock in defense contractors like Lockheed Martin. I mean, Filibusted wasn't around the last time, and we've always regretted that we didn't have the chance to explain why it was crazy.
We could have single-handedly shifted the war sentiment with our snark.
But this war seems a little different from the last one.
You mean because we're not actually calling this one a war?
Read your history books, Jay. We do that all the time. But seriously, at least so far, we're seeing a clear enemy, multiple allies, and most importantly, a humanitarian cause we can all get behind.
When 40,000 Yazidis, one of the oldest minority populations in Iraq, are being hunted by ISIL and forced to flee their homes, it's understandable why the U.S. would feel a clear, moral obligation to intervene.
And we have been supporting a related minority population in the region as well. We've been providing arms and ammunition to the Kurds, who have had some success in resisting ISIL's expansion.
I know you don't expect us to say this, but thanks, America. But before we start standing on tables singing the national anthem, let's make sure the U.S. is really living up to its own hype.
Filibustered has never been afraid of a little healthy skepticism.
Much as we'd love to believe that the U.S. has always supported the interests of the huddled masses yearning to breathe free,
we do have a history of doing not that.
So please hold while we unravel our official filibustered scroll of times the U.S. has done not that.
Section 1, paragraph 1. The United States was but a wee babe.
You know what, Sarah? We only have 10 minutes. Maybe we should stick to talking about the Kurds for now.
Okay, okay. The year was 1973. U.S. President Richard Nixon was being a crook.
Well, of course he was, but please get to your point about the Kurds.
I'm just setting the scene. In 1973, President Nixon began funding Kurdish guerrillas, helping to stave off attacks from a well-known Soviet-backed leader named Saddam Hussein.
And let me guess, 2 years later, we cut off all funding to the minority group that we previously supported, just as the USSR is giving Iraq 40 military aircraft to use against them, and ultimately 280,000 Kurds were forced to leave their homes?
Wow, Jay, it's almost like it's the 21st century and you can Google the conclusion of my story.
I have no idea what you're talking about. But for any NSA agents trolling my Google history, please forward any articles about U.S.-Kurdish relations to your friends at the State Department.
Jay, if the NSA were looking at your Google history, you'd risk causing the next great Red Scare.
We should set up a War News Radio bail fund in case that happens.
But really, the U.S. tendency to forget about minority rights movements when they no longer benefit us doesn't end there.
In the 1980s, Iran was at the top of the BuzzFeed list of countries we didn't particularly like. And so, we were willing to ignore a few of Saddam's shadier actions against the Kurds, so long as he continued to act as Iran's buffer.
And I'm sure the Kurds who lost their loved ones in Saddam's chemical weapons attacks in 1988 were really comforted by the knowledge that Iran was being punished for its attempts to militarize and develop nuclear weapons.
And I'm sure the Kurds slept peacefully when it was revealed that the U.S. had been secretly selling missiles to our supposed enemy, Iran.
But all good things have to come to an end. And for the United States, Saddam Hussein had gone the way of the Star Wars prequels.
In 1990, Iraq occupied Kuwait, and yet again, the United States cared deeply about minority populations. This time, Saddam had gone too far.
The first Gulf War was a resounding American success, forcing Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait. The Kurds were inspired, certain that a country so committed to freedom and independence would give them all the support they needed in their fight for autonomy.
Domestic support for the war had always been focused on this rah-rah liberal ideal that we were supporting a persecuted group. And that's kind of what we did, eventually. There were some airstrikes after 1.5 million Kurds had already been displaced from their homes.
So here you have President H.W. Bush highlighting the moral high ground of U.S. actions. Quote, "While the world waited, Saddam Hussein systematically raped, pillaged, and plundered a tiny nation no threat to his own."
I'm sure the Kurds really appreciated that sentiment as they waited, and waited, and waited, for the U.S. to do something.
And they're still waiting. It's 2014, and we keep talking about the Kurds as a people who deserve our support.
Now, we want to be clear that there were good reasons for U.S. action in 1991 to be as limited as it was. There's this one quote of Dick Cheney's that stands out to me as one of the only things he's ever said that made me kind of okay with the fact that he wasn't immediately arrested when he shot that guy in the face.
Wait, Jay, but there are so many better reasons to arrest Dick Cheney.
Sarah, we're not allowed to accuse Dick Cheney of war crimes on the air.
Right, sorry. We were talking about Dick Cheney making sense. In 1994, he literally foreshadowed what would go wrong if we tried to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
He said that the U.S. wouldn't have support, that we would just end up occupying Iraq, that we wouldn't have anyone to replace Saddam, and that the country would just dissolve into factional strife.
Oh my god, maybe he's the fortune teller.
Yes, Dick Cheney sits in the topmost room of the North Tower of Hogwarts, shaping the minds of young neoconservative Gryffindors.
Harry Potter and the Project for a New American Century?
You're a wizard, Donald Rumsfeld.
It's Leviosa, not Iraq has weapons of mass destruction.
Is Harry Potter even funny anymore?
Jay, we're too young to be asking if our pop culture references are dated.
Regardless, the point is not that we should have removed Saddam earlier, or forced him to give up land and give the Kurds autonomy. But if you're going to sell your war on the premise of supporting the rights of minorities abroad, you can't keep denying these people their right to statehood. You can't have it both ways.
Which brings us to today's conflict. Yet again, the U.S. is financially and militarily supporting the Kurds. Yet again, we're emphasizing the rights of a minority population. We are selling this as a humanitarian crisis. And it is. But we at Filibustered are skeptical that the U.S. will maintain that rhetoric if ISIL is defeated.
Is it really that surprising that people no longer believe it when the U.S. claims the moral high ground? This is the rhetoric we use when trying to sell wars to our own population, but it doesn't seem to be working abroad. Other countries and even the Kurds themselves are suspicious. They always assume we have an ulterior motive. And of course they do, with a track record like ours.
And this situation isn't unique to the Kurds. Western support for minority populations led to the creation of the Assad dynasty in Syria. Ironically, the US's new favorite punching bag.
Or is he our ally against ISIL? I can't keep track anymore.
You can argue that this is the way the world has always worked, that states need to justify their actions while also thinking about their own self-interest. But it's no longer in the US's self-interest if no one believes us anymore.
Unless we want to do things Roman Empire style, throw in a toga, start expanding our borders, we should probably actually live up to our own rhetoric. Or at least stop using it to justify adding a new war to the stockpile every few years.
Well, hope you enjoy the rants about Western imperialism as much as we do.
For the new Preacher Filibustered, I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Sarah Morrell. It's been a pleasure. At least for us.
Since September 27th, Central, the financial center of Hong Kong, has been effectively shut down by crowds protesting for universal suffrage. Other parts of the city have also been shut down as a result of the current protest movement. Catherine Kwok and Natasha Chuck report on issues of police violence, surprising instances of environmental awareness, and the international response that arose from the Umbrella Revolution.
There were like thousands of people on the road, and it has disturbed the order of the traffic. So the police, they could not possibly evacuate the people in a very efficient manner. So they began using tear gas. This is the first time ever that the police used tear gas. So I was from afar. I was on the bridge near the Tamabart. And once the tear gas was used, although it was very distant from me, it was very pungent, and my eyes were burning, my skin were hurting, and I was running away from the tear gas.
You just heard Priscilla, a student from University of Hong Kong, recount her experience at the Occupy Central protest. Thousands of Hong Kong citizens have gathered on major roads in multiple parts of the city in an act of civil disobedience for democracy and universal suffrage. Following a citywide student strike and gathering near the government headquarters that began on September 22nd, Occupy Central organizer Benny Tai announced the beginning of the movement on the morning of the 27th. While Tai initiated the protest, the current gatherings consist of three organizers: Occupy Central, Federation of Students, and Scholarism, a high school student political group. Prominent demands from protesters include removing the nomination committee from China's proposal for Hong Kong's chief executive elections, the resignation of current chief executive Leung Chun-ying, and the abolishing of Legislative Council's functional constituency. Many were worried that the 1,200-delegate nomination committee that includes numerous business elites would limit chief executive candidates to only those who appeal to the interests of China and the upper class of Hong Kong. Student protesters said the proposed framework is moving backwards instead of bringing progress.
On the 28th of September, I was one of the protesters expressing my opinions towards the nomination method of the chief executive of the HKSAR government peacefully. However, the HKSAR police used the pepper spray and the tear gas to attack all protesters. I loudly remind my friends nearby to stay away from the tear gas. Therefore, I breathed in a large amount of tear gas. I was really angry with the immoral behavior of the HKSAR government and police. I am now hereby to urge the international countries and the international cities to condemn the immoral behavior of the HKSAR government and police.
Like Priscilla, Billy, a student from University of Hong Kong, was also confronted with pepper spray and tear gas when he joined the demonstrations. In order to disperse protesters, the police have used tear gas, pepper spray, and batons, which 370 local and international solicitors, among others, have condemned as being overly violent tools. The Occupy Central movement has become known as the Umbrella Revolution for the protesters' use of umbrellas to shield themselves. In addition to the umbrellas, protesters have also received praise across social media for actively cleaning and recycling their waste at gatherings and writing apologetic signs to people who were inconvenienced. In addition to the seas of people, large amounts of donated supplies have been gathered at the protests, including food, banners, and plastic wrap for the protection against tear gas and pepper spray. Clogged with people and police barricades, Central and Admiralty, among other parts of the city, have been effectively shut down. 40% of bus services have been rerouted or cancelled, according to the Assistant Commissioner in the Transportation Bureau. And to many surprise, along with the clearer streets, Hong Kong has also been greeted with clearer skies due to the decreased traffic. On the economic front, while Hong Kong SME Development Federation President Edward Lam claims small to medium-sized enterprises may consider shifting their investments away, the protests won't cause serious damages to the economy, according to Marcus Chan, head of research of Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan at the property firm of CBRE.
Even though we are not very optimistic on the future, we can't just stay there not doing anything, accepting the so-called fake election system. We at least has a clear mind to differentiate, you know, a real democracy or fake democracy. This is the least we can do. So we will stick to that line, saying the truth, rejecting something which is not genuine.
Legislative Councillor Ka Ki Kwok, a member of the Alliance for True Democracy and participant of the Occupy Central movement, says he is not optimistic about the outcome of the protests, given the hardline stance of President Xi Jinping and his deputies. However, he says he will continue to fight alongside Hong Kong to reach true democracy. While the Occupy Central movement is based in Hong Kong, many demonstrations have sprung up across the world in response. In support of the protests, more than 37,000 students studying abroad in North America and Europe have organized and participated in their own demonstrations under the name of Wear Yellow for Hong Kong. The Hong Kong Association in Swarthmore has also organized a gathering on October 1st to show solidarity in support of the protesters back home.
Swarthmore wanted to join it because we feel this is a very important issue for students from Hong Kong, and we want to support our friends who are in the streets fighting for our future, fighting for our freedom, and fighting for our democracy. We feel that this event is actually really meaningful because for us, we couldn't really participate in the protest. We're also trying to get foreign attention to make sure that everyone in America, or even the world, to know more about what is happening in Hong Kong, to understand what we are fighting for. We're fighting for democracy, we're fighting for freedom, and we think that is important. We think that the Hong Kong issue is not as well known in America and in the Western countries than what it should have been, partly because people believed that Hong Kong had democracy, which wasn't the case, and it's not the case now. So we want to make sure that people know what is happening in Hong Kong. We want everyone to help Hong Kong, we want everyone to know what is happening in Hong Kong.
That was Chen Hei Wong, a representative of the HKSA. Heading into the sixth day of Occupy Central, the chief executive announced that he will not be stepping down despite the students' threat to enter several government buildings. Instead, he has appointed Chief Secretary Carrie Lam and some senior administrators to meet with the student groups. Police Public Relations Bureau's Chief Superintendent Steve Hui stated in a press conference that the use of tear gas met international guidelines as pepper spray was not effective in pushing back the crowds, and that the police will not tolerate any protester that enters the chief executive's office.
Thanks to Nora Lam from University of Hong Kong's Campus TV for helping with the interviews. For War News Radio, I'm Natasha Chak.
And I'm Catherine Kwok.